Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
This week in Retronauts, Lucifer, I'm home. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts, episode 666.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
This is the most evil episode of Retronauts to date, and as such, we have dedicated this episode entirely to Satan. That's actually very glib. So, obviously, 666, you know, you can't get to that number of a podcast and not do something. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to roll out a sort of branch of Retronauts that I've been developing for a while called Trends and Influences, which we kind of dipped a little toe into this past summer, talking about political trends and things like that that influence video games. But I do want to start looking at culture and history that surrounded video game history and influenced it and isn't necessarily directly about video games. So my thought was, having lived through the 1980s and experienced this firsthand in my conservative Christian town, the satanic panic of the 1980s, which I thought, well, that will be a light, frothy topic because that was a goofy thing. I remember, you know, getting trotted out to hear lectures about how evil D&D was. And, you know, so this will be a fun, lightweight sort of thing. And then I actually did the research and reading and watched documentaries and discovered, no, actually, kind of like the communist hearings, the 1950s, the Satanic Panic, even though it was stupid and seems inexplicable in hindsight, it really wrecks some people's lives. So this is maybe a little more serious a topic than I intended it to be, but nevertheless, it is something that has had a real impact on video games and is something that I think is very relevant to today's culture. And it kind of interfaces indirectly with video games in a lot of ways. And we will talk about that. But mostly we're going to talk about what the literal hell this was. And to join me on my spelunking into the satanic realms this episode, we have our returning regular from Japan.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Diamond Fight, and I'm here to argue on behalf of the defendant, so you might consider me a Beelzebub barrister.
Okay.
I won't do that voice anymore. Thank you very much.
No, it's great. I'm just a simple country podcaster.
I don't have suspenders, but I'm doing the gesture with a... Yeah.
And also returning to Retronauts for the first time in quite a while, a former Retronauts East person who is no longer in the East... But we still like him anyway. Please, who are you?
Hey, sorry, that's my ringtone.
Unfortunately,
hang on.
That did not come through in the transmission.
Oh, did it not come through? Oh, that's a bummer. That was a good joke.
It was probably copyrighted and Zoom was like, no.
Yeah, it was running with the devil. I'll send you the drop.
Okay.
I'll send you the drop so you can use it. Yes, it's me.
Oh,
it's Chris
Sims. You can just do the Chris Sims. You can do the isolated David Lee Roth audio track from Running Where the Devil. It's really
fun. Oh, one time.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah, Chris, I am.
Welcome back.
I'm here. I'm so happy to be back on Retronauts, and hail Satan, everybody.
Yeah, when I thought of the devil, I thought, oh, Chris Sims needs to come back. That's because Chris Sims co-hosted. Is it still a running thing?
It is indeed.
A podcast with our fourth guest this episode. Why don't you please introduce yourself and tell us about that podcast and why I might have said, hey, you guys should join us.
Okay. Hello. Hi. How is everyone? My name is Benito, and I, with Chris, we host ApocryPals, which is a podcast about Bible and stuff that is Bible adjacent. And we talk about it in a way that tries to make a semi-scholarly approach to the Bible accessible to people who are from outside of academic circles. It's a comedy show, but also we're not making fun of the Bible, except the dumb parts, I guess. That's probably fair. That's the show. We do Apocrypha as well. We do Saints Live. Sometimes we look at Jack Chick tracks. That's a little relevant to today's discussion. Before we get too deep into everything, though, can I ask a quick question? I should have written this down. Hold on. What is video games?
it's like, you know, a chess, but with D-pads.
You remember Bible Adventures? We did an episode on that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Bible. Yeah. Oh, like Bible Adventures. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So different kinds
and on El Shaddai. Ascension of the Metatron.
We do have an episode on El Shaddai, Ascension of the Metatron. We've got a couple episodes on video games.
Awesome. Video games are where you attack and dethrone God, actually.
So they fit right
into this topic.
Yeah, fair enough.
I would like to add, real quick, we do not, unlike what my mom seems to think the show is about, we are not tearing down biblical scripture. But we are also not a comedy podcast in the way that Mike Warnke is a comedian.
Oh, buddy. There
Something
we go.
That will come up later in the episode.
Good. Did you watch that video I sent you, Chris?
No, because I already was familiar with it.
All right. So this episode is going to be me and Diamond and a lot of in-jokes that we don't get. But that's okay because
all will be revealed.
It's going to make everyone's lives better. So just as a quick content warning, like I said, the Satanic Panic even though it was deeply stupid and really hard to explain in hindsight, there is some pretty rough stuff involved in that. Some of the origins of it and the results that it had on people's lives, and also the connections it has with present day society and unhinged people. So just as a warning, if you're sensitive to that sort of thing, you may want to say, perhaps I should skip ahead to episode 667, and that is okay. But for those of you who are interested in kind of digging into some of the nitty gritty, and we're not going to get too into that sort of stuff, but just to kind of learn more about this really global trend that was exported from America, one of America's worst exports, actually, and how it had an impact on video games and other media, stay tuned, because the devil is in the details. So before we get started, I would like to recommend you do a little external reading on this if this topic interests you. A lot of my memory was refreshed on this topic by a fairly recent documentary that you can rent on YouTube and some other places called Satan Wants You. And it is an attempt to kind of dig into the book that really kicked off the satanic panic in America and in Canada, I suppose. And it actually reaches out to people who were involved in the periphery of the whole thing and whose lives were impacted, who, you know, were in law enforcement or media at the time and, you know, stopped and said, what's going on here? Which not enough people did. So it's a pretty interesting, documentary. And a lot of information has been culled from that, although I did, you know, do additional readings. So I'm not just trusting one source. Like, everything that we're going to talk about has been pretty well vetted, I think, and corroborated with other sources. Does anyone have any other recommendations that they would like to put out there?
Yeah, I can highly recommend episodes of the podcast You're Wrong About, where they dive into a lot of stuff, but, the creators of the podcast are, Michael Hobbs, who was a reporter, and, Sarah Marshall, who was writing a book on the Satanic Panic at the time. And so
she is in that documentary.
Yeah.
Because she has a very memorable name.
Yes.
I will not forget Sarah Marshall.
You shouldn't, but they did a very, really good deep dive into Michelle Remembers. They did a very big deep dive into Michael Warnke, who I know Benito is eager to talk about, and also plenty of other topics, but a lot of Satanic Panic stuff.
I gotta say, that documentary is a great watch, but if nothing else, you get to meet a Wiccan police officer from British Columbia, which is just, that's such a wonderful sentence to be.
Sentence that had never existed before that.
No, great stuff, though. Honestly, it's really, you know, as I was a child in the 80s, so this all kind of washed over me at the time, and it seemed like something that was very strange. You know, why are some people on television talking about dead babies and eating the babies and looking at the babies and the baby smiled back at me? Like, all these things were just on television all the time, and people took it as serious. And even as a child, I was like, wait, what are you talking about? And to come back and realize, oh, no, this really was a huge thing that started out with basically a single person and her doctor, and who exactly wanted the story to get big and who exactly was embellishing is kind of a debate, I would say. But from this flashpoint in Canada, of all places, it blew up and hit the tinderbox of America, especially American television. And boy, did it run wild, and boy, did it... It's still going. It's still going in certain places. There are things happening today that are absolutely little, you know, what, brush fires. That are left over from the ignition 40 years
ago.
Or
huge conflagrations in some cases. Yeah, so the notes that I put together for this episode were pretty extensive, about 12 pages of notes. And it does get into sort of the origins, like some of the influences, some of the reasons that the Satanic Panic happened beyond just, you know, sensationalism. Like, it was just a kind of thing that hit at a very volatile time in our culture. And there were a lot of external factors that just caused people to become unbelievably credulous and say, yes, I do believe that 2 million babies a year are turned into fodder for Satan and eaten and turned into candle tallow, without really stopping to think how many babies are born in America each year. And it turns out it's not that many more than 2 million. So, you know, there is the question of how are all these babies being born and stolen away? And somehow it's never happened to anyone that we know. But I guess the idea is just, this doesn't happen in our town. It's the other places that are bad. And so we're going to talk about some of those things. I do want to go a little bit out of order with the notes, since Diamond sort of got the ball rolling there. I want to ask what your experiences with Satanic Panic were back in the day. Chris, it seemed like you had an extensive list of notes that maybe you want to talk about. So maybe cherry pick a few gems and we'll go from there.
Well, I know Benito and I both grew up in the South, and Jeremy, I know that you were either from the South or South adjacent.
Nah, I grew up in Texas, which is more the West.
There we go.
But I was born in Michigan, so that's not the South at all.
But very, very much in that same Bible Belt vein.
Oh, yes. We were the buckle of the Bible Belt, is what everyone called Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah. Fortunately, I never really ran into Satanic Panic stuff directly in a lot of ways. It was just sort of like in the air. I know that had I gone to, say, First Baptist instead of Swan Lake Presbyterian, as I did growing up, that things probably would have been a little bit different. But definitely had people come to my school to talk up, like to give talks to an assembly of the entire student body about the devil, which is not strictly legal. And I know that some of the conversation was about video games. The one thing that happened to me in particular was I had actually pre-ordered the Super Nintendo version of Doom, which, as we all know, is the best version of Doom.
That's what YouTubers tell us in the year 2025, yes.
Yeah, if you're gonna play one, play that one, and then you won't like first-person shooters, and you'll really get into Metroidvanias.
Although I will say we at Limited Run Games have done a bang-up job of doing really weird, cool stuff with a reissue of that. So try that version of Doom for Super NES. Anyway, well, please, Chris, go on.
What you should have done was release the T-shirt that I got for pre-ordering it at Toys R Us, which was a shirt, the black T-shirt, that in like bloody red letters said, "Nothing can save you." And it had the Doom logo on it, which is a pretty intense shirt. And I did wear that to school exactly one time. And the reason there was not a second time was because a classmate did approach me after I had noticed significant whispering amongst my classmates. One did approach me to let me know that there was someone who could save me. And his name was Jesus Christ.
Well, now you know.
Yeah.
And that is at least half the battle.
Yeah, but I definitely grew up in that time when, I mean, the things that I like are video games, comic books, and Dungeons and Dragons, all of which have been the subject of various moral panics over the years.
Do you have the copy of the comic book that has Kiss's actual blood in the ink?
I do not. I did work on a Kiss Army of Darkness crossover, though. Hmm. So, you know, I'm not too far from having blood in my comics, I guess, maybe.
Fair enough. Diamond, you kind of got this ball rolling, like I said earlier. So what about you? What were your brushes with Satan and panicking over Satan?
Well, I may be the most outlier here because, you know, I'm from New York City. And
New York City?
Yes.
Get a rope.
Where the best salsa's made. No, but, and also We were joking around before the podcast started, and someone said the words "jugoku," which is very funny because I'm actually Jewish. So, yeah, Satan and I aren't really connected directly. We don't really have a lot in common. But it's still, I was still a child in the 1980s, and I was invariably impacted by all these things that came up and came around us, and you know, a lot of my friends were not Jewish, so I would hear them talk about things that were just, you know, holidays and important matters that were in their lives. Like, okay, that's fascinating. I don't know what you talk about, but okay, that's great. But this, you know, it kept bleeding into because, yeah, as Chris mentioned, a lot of the stuff that I liked was things that these sort of people seemed to hate, and they seemed to have decided that, oh, those, you know, that music that you enjoy is actually being made by people who worship Satan, and they're records are designed to make you kill yourself. And, you know, again, even as a child, I'm like, wait, so the band wants me to kill myself, but wouldn't they just want me to buy more of their music? And so it was a constant climate that only died out. It died out is the wrong word. It faded away, but it never truly disappeared. Because even years later, when we sort of talked about this sort of, the situation in past tense, like it was all behind us. Like, no, it kept going. It kept going. You know, I think there used to be a baseball team called the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. And I sincerely believe one reason they changed the name of that team is because people, you know, they're in Florida. I think people were actually upset that they kept using the word devil. I believe that. I don't have a source to go to, but I've remember reading stories about certain people who are like, hey, why is team called the Devil Rays? Should we really be talking about the devil that way? It's like, it's a fish. But today, the Tampa Bay Rays, there's no devil there anymore.
You know, I've been to church potlucks where they serve deviled eggs. I've never been able to reconcile that morally.
I love those eggs.
Benito, what about you?
Yeah, so, yeah, I grew up in a very religious family. People who have listened to Apocrypals know that I come from a very churchy background and of the evangelical American type. So yeah, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church and I spent a lot of my time at church. I was definitely a church kid. And so, I encountered a lot of the elements of the satanic panic. It was one of those things where it was kind of part of my day to day in the sense of like, this is media you can't consume or this is bad or, you know, don't do this. Not the thing about, baby blood sacrifice and sexual abuse. Like that's the stuff I didn't find out about until much later, when I was an adult and I was like, oh, that, turns out there's a lot more than just like backward masking, at the heart of this thing. But yeah, like definitely, you know, my mom was concerned about this stuff. You know, my mom is the kind of person who definitely believed that, Mazes and Monsters was a true story. If you guys know that movie, she definitely quoted that to me one time. She's like, you can't play Dungeons and Dragons because of this one time that Tom Hanks got lost in the sewer. And that's a true story. But like at various times, I was not allowed to watch Bewitched because that was like too much occult for my mom. And, yeah, you know, I listened to Christian rock music up until I was about 16 and my parents couldn't stop me from picking other stuff to listen to. But I still kept the sleeve of my Pixies record turned around backwards so they couldn't see the naked breasts on the cover of Surfer Rosa. So like a lot of the stuff, you know, I grew up 80s, 90s. And so I was definitely in the circle of people who were like pointing fingers outwards, right? During this stuff. So, and my mom very concerned about like, the Satan worshipers that they're out. Don't go out on New Year's Eve. That's when the drunks are out at the Satans. So that was my family. So I definitely grew up with some elements of it, but the daycare stuff was new to me until much later.
Yeah, so for myself, I think I actually grew up further right on the religious spectrum than you did, Benito. I was my family 3 times a week would go to services at the Church of Christ.
People like to go, oh, Southern Baptist, that's the worst one. It's like, no, you think it's the worst one because they're the loudest one. There are many that are a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, it was a church where we didn't use instruments because instrumental music was not directly permitted, like verbally permitted in the New Testament. It was never actually like excoriated or warned against, just never actually, you know, there's nowhere in the Bible that says you can use instruments in your music to worship God. So it was all.
There's a lot of instruments played in the Bible.
Yeah, not
yes,
in the
but
New
it's
Testament.
The Old Testament, my friend.
Yeah, that's how my grandpa was raised. My grandpa was Church of Christ, and so he had not heard an organ until he married my grandma and converted to being a Baptist.
So the interesting thing is that my family kind of got into becoming part of the Church of Christ not because of the conservative streak in it, but because it was more like an intellectual historical thing. They were more interested, especially my father was interested in the fact that it was really sort of kind of a back to the roots sort of approach to Christianity and religion and didn't have a lot of the ceremony attached to it. But, you know, it did attract a lot of very, very conservative types. And I would never, ever want to go back to that church in this day and age. But back then, I don't feel like it was so bad. And part of that, I think, it helps that my parents were not and are not very conservative. They're pretty progressive and left-leaning, probably because they grew up in Flint, Michigan, and it's kind of hard not to just soak in that Michael Moore ambiance growing up there. So, you know, the time that I spent in church was very much about like, hey, learn to be a good person, don't be an asshole, and God's out there doing stuff, whatever. But like, really, you should think about who you are and the kinds of things that you do. So I kind of got away lucky, and I still have a good relationship with my parents because they're not like twisted and bent into using Christianity and religion as a weapon to hurt other people, which is kind of rare these days. And it's nice to see. But, you know, as a result of that, there was a lot of very sort of cultural and social conservatism surrounding us. And, you know, I had friends who, like, the only music they would listen to was Stryper and the Boogie Boys because they, maybe Amy Grant, because they were all religious and so forth. So, you know, a lot of my friends also were kind of like, this is stupid. So when one Wednesday night at Bible class, we were pulled out of our class and dragged across the street to the Christian college next to our church so that some police detectives could lecture us on the dangers of Dungeons and Dragons. I was probably like, I don't know, 12 or so. This was the late 80s. So we were all just kind of like, this seems ridiculous. And I had some friends who were very, very not having any part of it. But there were lots of people who did buy into it. And so I kind of grew up in this sort of mixed setting where there was a lot of like extremely straight-laced conservative Christianity and a lot of, you know, more laissez-faire mindsets. And so it was kind of hard for me to take the whole satanic panic thing seriously, because even as a 10 or 12-year-old, it just seemed kind of stupid. But, you know, the imagery and the concepts of satanic cults and rituals did seep into society and to pop culture and have become sort of perpetuated long beyond the point where everything to do with the satanic panic has been debunked and kind of shot down and killed off. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. Anyway, So that is the Satanic Panic, our personal experiences. Now let's talk about the origin story. And we're going to drop a pin in the year 1980, when lots of people who were cool died, like John Lennon, and a book called Michelle Remembers came out. And this book had been in development for like 4 or 5 years. It was basically a series of transcripts with commentary added based on therapy sessions where a woman named Michelle Smith went into sort of this deep trance state and talked about her repressed memories. And it turned out that when she was living in the sleepy town of Victoria, British Columbia, she was abducted for like 2 years by a satanic cult that did all kinds of horrible things to her, like make her eat babies and who knows what else. And it was horrible, just so bad. And so she would, you know, share these experiences on tape, and her therapist, Larry Pazder would transcribe them. And, you know, after a few years of this, he put together a complete book and they published it, and it became a massive best-selling hit that spread across the U.S. and Canada, I guess, and made people aware of all the terrible things that satanic cults were up to in our very own hometowns, doing horrible things to our children and just doing their best to unravel the delicate thread of civilization. It was truly, truly terrifying. It's weird because no one had actually seen these things happen, but she said she remembered it when she was in therapy, and therapy was still kind of, I guess, new at the time. So people were like, yes, okay, sure. Why not?
Definitely the idea of like repressed memories coming to the surface was new and had been really taking the world by storm, especially with regards to like sensationalized psychology stuff. This was also the era of, and this is something that is pointed out on You're Wrong About a Lot. This is the same era as Sybil, which is probably more well known now for the movie that Sally Field starred in about dissociative identity disorder, that was also later revealed to not entirely be based in fact. But Jeremy, I do want to point out, you say it turns out she had been kidnapped by satanic cults. Sure, Jan.
Yeah, I think it turned out she hadn't actually.
Wait, but she said it's true that there's a lot of evidence that she was, you know, having a happy, normal life during this period that she recounts having been in the thrall of Satan. But nevertheless, she said, like, don't you believe women?
It's kind of shocking in the documentary when, you know, because they talked to members of her family. Obviously, the Michelle of Michelle Remembers did not want to be part of the documentary, but they talked to members of her family and talked to members of Pazder's family. Pazder has actually since passed away, but his ex-wife and his daughter were there. And, you know, one thing that gets lost in all this is that at one point, the story changed from I was abducted to my mother gave me to the Satanist cults. And Michelle's younger sister is the documentary. She's like, I really can't believe my mother would give my sister to Satanists. Like, that wasn't part of my childhood. And it's just it's kind of like, wait, no, you're really saying that your mother turned you over? And it's also, I mean, it's somewhat convenient the fact that by the time she says this, her mother had long since passed away because she died of cancer and her father was just not in the picture anymore. So she kind of had an easy out there to sort of point the finger at people who weren't there to defend themselves. And everyone just sort of said, oh, well, that's a terrible story. We're so glad you survived this. And then when they start asking questions about, you know, do you have any scars from the time they chopped you with knives or whatever? And all the like her stories just include these sort of magical outs that, oh, no, the angels came to me and healed me. At one point, the Virgin Mary appears, but she's speaking French. And Michelle denies speaking French, which to me is an American. Like, wait, I thought all Canadians speak French. And her family's like, we literally, our grandfather spoke French. You spoke French. Why did you tell people you don't speak French anymore? Like, there's just so many weird things that, like own goals. Like, wait, why did you put this in your story?
Here's what I'll say about Michelle Remembers. First of all, Michelle and Dr. Pazder did leave their spouses and get married. And there's a lot in that book about like all the intense time they were spending together. It almost like they needed an excuse to keep spending intense time with each other before they left their families for each other. And then did, to their credit, remain together until his death. Michelle remembers his bullshit. I don't think we can say that enough. But I will say, I don't think it's bullshit in the way that, like, what are their names, Benito? Earl and Lorraine, the Warrens?
Ed and Lorraine Warren, yeah.
Ed and Lorraine, yeah. I don't think they're charlatans in the way that the Warrens are charlatans. I think they did believe what they were saying to an extent of, like, I think Michelle was clearly going through a lot of stuff, like, she had initially started seeing Dr. Pazder.
It's P-A-Z. Pazder.
I always want to call him Dr. Pastor because that's
Dr.
Pastor. Very appropriate. But she had been seeing him because of, like, you know, a lot of trauma that she had related to, like, having a miscarriage and, like, things in her relationship that weren't going well with her husband. So I think there was clearly, like, stuff going on there that then became something else that there's no evidence of it ever happening. And like a lot of things that you get with moral panics, virtually all of which are bullshit, is that the lack of evidence then becomes not this didn't happen. It becomes those crafty Satanists are so good at hiding the fact that they're murdering 2 million babies a year.
So, you know, the thing is, talking about the inconsistencies and everything, and Michelle remembers, I feel like they did not know how big this book would become. I don't think they anticipated the amount of scrutiny they'd experience. I think they wanted, you know, to make some money to have, you know, a minor hit book, not for it to become an international sensation that would put them on the news on a daily basis and get them on the talk show circuit and so forth. So, yeah, I think they didn't really clearly think through the stories here and spend much time sort of vetting the book for logical fallacies and so forth. But you're right, Chris, like the sort of self-fulfilling element to it where they can say, well, you know, that doesn't seem right because there's some sort of, you know, shenanigans happening here. It is kind of an easy out. I don't want to just like dump on these people because I get the impression that, you know, for all the problems they caused and that they participated in, I still feel like they were kind of messed up and, you know, there were some mental trauma issues and things like that. And, you know, I don't want to like dance on that and make light of it. But at the same time, like they really screwed some people's lives up. And so it kind of becomes this difficult like question of where do you draw the line of accountability and how much should these people be responsible for? Because, you know, once the book did become a breakout and a bestseller, they hit the TV circuit. I mean, I remember seeing these conversations on TV that this was kind of the peak of daytime talk television where like anytime you turned on the TV in the afternoon, there were three or four stations available. And if it wasn't playing a soap opera or a rerun of Gilligan's Island, it was playing a talk show that was a man or a woman. And the name of the show was that person's first name. And they would have a panel of people out for the audience to either celebrate or excoriate. And that was a daily thing. You know, Sally, Jesse, Raphael, Oprah Winfrey got her start in this era. Geraldo Rivera, Maury Povich. I can't remember.
Donahue
who else.
Would have been Phil the big Donahue, one for Phil this Donahue one.
Well, he was the original and the best. I feel like Donahue didn't quite wallow in the mud as much as a lot of the other shows. I feel like he tended to keep his nose clean, relatively speaking. But, you know, someone like Sally tended to just kind of go in for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they were everywhere. And, you know, it's repetition. It's like in Snake Eater, you keep eating the same animal over and over again, and eventually Snake will learn to like it. It's the same idea with information. You keep drilling it into people's heads. You keep repeating these same comments over and over again. And eventually it takes on the ring of truth because you hear it so much. It must be true. You've heard it on so many different talk shows. Never mind that it's the same people on those talk shows always guesting. There's always some sort of different configuration, and it's always being parsed a different way by the host and presented a different way. So it must be true, because why would it be on television if it weren't? Why would so many people give this airtime if it weren't true? So, yeah, eventually people, I think, just started to buy into it. And because it was on TV, they didn't stop to say, well, this doesn't make any logical sense. This is all very stupid, and why should I buy into this? And so it just kind of was this self-perpetuating Ouroboros that just kept eating on its own tail and getting bigger and bigger.
And it's exciting. You know, it's the idea that there are secret cults around us and that are summoning literal demons and they're coming for your kids. Like, that is, it's hard to blame anyone for putting that on TV when their business is getting people to watch their TV show, even though it is ultimately like exceptionally harmful.
Yeah. I mean, I think you got like the elements of, you know, the introduction of kind of religious horror in the 70s. You've got, you know, The Exorcist is a big deal. The Omen is a big deal. Rosemary's Baby in the late 60s. And it's a thing where you can suddenly be like, oh, well, I believe in the devil. And, you know, so if this is what can happen, then my life is potentially more exciting. There could be a real demon. Speaking of my mom, as I was, my mom in the early 90s was very into the novels of Frank Peretti. I don't know if you're familiar with him,
mm-hmm.
but he had two novels. One was called This Present Darkness and one called Piercing the Darkness. And they were absolutely
taking me back here.
Yeah, absolutely. They were about demons having direct influence on our day to day life. There's angels in the book too, but like it's really he kind of tried to brand himself as the Christian Stephen King, but like the Stephen King of Kings.
There's only one king in my heart, sir.
and so there's like. You know, it's the broad Christian bookstore market reading this. And even though it's labeled fiction, but like, you know, when it's religious fiction, how fiction is it, you know, in your mind when you're reading it? Cause it's like, this could happen. The angels and demons are out there. So, you know, I do think there's an allure to the idea that like, I could be in a movie. I could be The Exorcist.
So you mentioned the movies of the 1960s and 70s, and one of the – I put together a section in the notes called The Kindling of the Satanic Panic, the dry wood that caught spark and burst into flames. One of those things, one of the elements that I isolated that kind of fed into this was in 1968, the Hays Code was dissolved. Yeah. And if you don't know what that is, that's a very – very conservative, morally conservative code that Hollywood adopted for its films. What was that in response to the communist panic of the 50s, or was it before that?
Well, no, it started older.
Yeah,
it started in the 30s.
Okay, was it in the 30s? Okay,
yeah, it was the it was what preceded the MPAA rating system that we have now. And so it was very similar to the Comics Code Authority, which, of course, mm-hmm. was created in response to a moral panic from the 50s.
Yep.
But it was a very strict set of things that you could and couldn't show in the movies until eventually you got to the 60s and people were like, this is too restrictive. And so they said, okay, well, I'm create a new system where you can have more adult content in your movies. And so, yeah, by the late 60s, there's suddenly a wealth of rated R material that wouldn't have been allowed prior to that.
Right. So in 1968, the Hays Code was formally dissolved, and Hollywood really wasted no time taking advantage of that. And Roman Polanski, most notably, which is kind of ironic because he's actually the guy you should worry about being around your kids. He adapted the 1967 novel Rosemary's Baby into a film in 1968. And this, it was very popular, very successful, and kicked off a massive, massive movement of films about satanic rituals, demonic possession. I mean, I linked to a page in the notes that just has like, here's a list of all the movies about Satan and demons in the 1970s. And it's an amazing list. It's so, there's so many of these movies. It was very, very on trend. And a lot of the things that are recounted and remembered in Michelle Remembers appear to be drawn very directly from some of these movies, like Sybil and so forth. And it really feels like, you know, whether deliberate or just because she was put into a trance-like state and that sort of half-waking, half-dream state where you're like having thoughts and they're not really conscious thoughts and you don't really have any control over them, but they seem very vivid and real. Like, you know, when you're first starting to fall asleep, I don't know what the origin was, but it really feels like she was processing a lot of things that had been in movies of the era and saying, oh, these happened to me. And no one stopped and said, hey, this kind of reminds me of that one flick I saw with Sally Field. There was never that kind of connection made, or at least not by anyone who had any presence, had any voice in the media. And so, you know, basically these lurid tales that were seemingly inspired by lurid movies created in the, you know, the wake of the creation of the MPAA and R-rated and X-rated movies sort of fed into Michelle Remembers and became the real, actual, factual story of a woman's life and the terrible experiences she had as a kid.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really notable about Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist in particular is that they kind of moved the idea of the occult into urban and suburban spaces, because in earlier movies, you have devil worshiping cults and that kind of stuff, but it's guys in robes over giant horned altars and that kind of stuff. Right. It's very, you know, very extravagant. Whereas the idea of Rosemary's Baby is this stuff is happening right under your nose in your apartment building, the nice old
in
couple.
The basement of your pizza place.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, in the case of The Exorcist, you, an old board game you find in the basement can be the key. My mom definitely freaked out about Ouija boards. But yeah, so it's like the idea that this is happening in the modern world, it's happening in the urban world, it's happening all around us. And it's there's a thin like veneer. It's below the surface, but you only have to scratch it to find it, right? So
I was gonna say we played with a Ouija board on a church trip and it felt so transgressive. Then later on that same trip, I was playing Bionic Commando for NES with someone and beat the game, and they saw Hitler say damn and then his head exploded. It was the most evil church trip of all time. Diamond, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I think one reason why I feel like it's okay to get really, really angry at the people who made this book, because even whatever they were experiencing, whatever Michelle experienced in her life, whatever this doctor thought he was trying to help with, in making this book, they worked with actual church officials. They got money from church officials. The Catholic Church benefited from this extremely. And it reminds me of a line many years later in From Dusk Till Dawn, where they're, you know, surrounded by vampires, and he's trying to convince, you know, Harvey Keitel, fallen pastor. It's like, no, we're here. These things are creatures from hell. If hell exists, therefore God exists. So you need to get back on the back on the horse here and bless this holy water for us. But I feel like if you're a member of the church and you see this stuff happening and you see pop culture being, you know, in your eyes invaded by satanic imagery, that to you must be a boon, because of course, if people believe in Satan, then that must also back belief in God. You know what I mean? It's like, we are selling the cure for evil, so we need to make sure people know evil is real. Mm. Which is why I feel like this whole satanic panic, which they, you know, obviously, you know, there's not like one CEO church that made this all happen, but people, you know, their local like father or whatever was definitely involved in them. At one point they flew to the Vatican. It's really not clear what they did to the Vatican, but part of the story is they flew to the Vatican and gave their evidence to someone. And yep. That helped the story. That somehow made the story seem all the more, you know, official. Like, oh, with this all happened, and we went to the Vatican, we reported our findings to someone in Italy who spoke Italian, maybe even Latin. And it just lended an air of authenticity to their story that couldn't possibly have any. But that was good, because the people, you know, who want you to fear Satan, that's good. That's good news for them. It's like, oh yes, that's evil. We are good. Look at that. Look at us. You, which side do you want?
Evil is good. Evil is the job.
I don't want, like, a couple things. I don't want to say that or intimate that I believe that it is that being religious or having any sort of faith or spirituality is naive, because I genuinely don't think that. Like, you know, Benito and I refer to ourselves on Apocryphals as non-believers and not atheists, because of the connotation of being an atheist on the internet is like, actually.
Yeah, big like, time, yeah.
And that's not...
Be my lobster.
Yeah, like that's not the way I actually feel. However, I do believe that it's easier to believe in one if you already have the other, right? Like, it's the Jimmy Olsen thing, right? Like, it's easier to get to Jimmy Olsen if you already have Superman. It's easier to get to Superman's friend who can marry a gorilla if you already have accepted the existence of Superman. That might sound dismissive, but I think a lot about Superman.
You will believe a man can marry a gorilla.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's the same thing of, like, the philosophy for years of, like, we can't do superhero movies because people aren't going to buy everything. And then someone made a movie that had Rocket Raccoon in it that made $1 billion. But that's a whole other discussion. The other thing is, you know, you mentioned Roman Polanski, and one of the things that is wildly not the most well-known thing about him is that he is connected on the victim side to the Manson family murders, which are, like, a scary, sensational, cult, violent thing that, like, actually happened and was a huge cultural impact, because those things are actually very rare. And those things, when they happen, are big news because of their rarity, and not as an indication that this is happening everywhere. But if you combine that bit of reality with the pop culture stuff of, you know, demons possessing you and your head turning all the way around and Satan babies and everything, you get Michelle Remembers. It is the most shameless pop culture mashup that I have not written.
No, that touches on something else that I added to my kindling section: the rise of a cult and satanic imagery in pop culture, actual cults, serial killers. I mean, there was this sort of rise, maybe not in the actual number of these things happening in America in the 1960s, 70s, but certainly in the visibility of them and the sensationalism of them, which is another thing, you know, media sensationalism, that's also in the kindling. But, you know, there were groups like Hare Krishna, which, you know, were founded with good intents, to things like Jonestown and Scientology, which were founded with ill intent and often had bad outcomes. You started to hear about these things kind of bubbling away in the background, and they were very not of the Judeo-Christian tradition. They were different and scary and didn't obey the rules. You know, at the same time, in 1966 or so, a guy named Anton LaVey founded something called the Church of Satan, which did not literally worship Satan as an actual physical being, not in the sense of, like, you know, Jesus was a dude who was nailed to a cross and he lived and he, you know, did things with fish and water and stuff. It was the idea behind the Church of Satan was basically it's like Atlas Shrugs, but with fun robes. It was very much about libertarianism and about self-actualization and thinking of yourself first. LaVey was kind of a showman, and I think he realized that his philosophy and his movement would have more visibility if he embraced transgressive imagery like Satan. But at no point does the Church of Satan actually say, oh yes, like Satan is this dude who lives in hell. He's trapped in the ice, but we think he's really cool. And it's great that he has the anti-pope stuck in his mouth. We love that about him. And he's the best. We literally worship him. That's not what it is. But because he called it the Church of Satan, that was kind of a boogeyman for a lot of people I knew growing up. Like Anton LaVey was a known name. And when people talked about him, you know, my classmates or whatever, it was either with genuine fear or with this sort of like, here's something that is bad and is kind of cool. Here's a guy who's like so evil. He founded the Church of Satan. He is so rad. So, you know, you had these cults and you had the Church of Satan, which was absolutely not a cult, just sort of a movement, basically celebrating the human spirit, if you want to say that. But it draped itself in religious imagery. And having that kind of in the background, just sort of bubbling away and people in people's awareness, causing fear to percolate. Like, I do think that helped make Michelle Remembers a little easier to swallow. Like, oh, I've been hearing about all of these cults and all of these murders and about Satan's own church on the news. So maybe when this woman says that she was kidnapped and you know, like she had to turn babies into candles so that she could, you know, use them for rituals around a pentagram. That could be real. Who knows?
Yeah, it is very funny to me to whenever you dive into satanic panic stuff, which is something that I've always found very fascinating. We'll get to my obsession with police training videos later. But it's always very funny to me to remember, like, yeah, the Church of Satan is exactly as old as the Batman television show. That was the same time. That was all going down at once.
I mean, that Batman mask does look a little devilish. And what are those motions he does with the Batuzzi swiping the V across his eye? I don't know.
Oh, no, that's not satanic. That's acknowledging the Illuminati. That's a whole different thing.
Oh, sorry. That's a different cult. I'm sorry, my mistake.
I think the element that a lot of people have missed out on. I mean, not if you like are aware of the online presence of the Church of Satan and whatever. I forget. I'm confused. There's like two different Churches of Satan, but like they're mostly there to troll Christians, specifically yeah. Like Christian cultural hegemony is kind of their main thing, right? And so it's like, why choose Satan? Well, because it would upset the right people, what they viewed as the right people, right? So it's kind of like, oh, that's kind of to be applauded. Good job, Church Satan. And then you see what the people, the members are like, and you're like, ah, never mind. Never mind. I don't need to applaud the Church of Satan. But, you know. Keep trolling, I guess.
You do not, under any circumstances, gotta hand it to him.
Questions 9, sing 99 and 90. and you'll be the devil's Bonnie.
So once Michelle Remembers became a hit and the authors began making the tour, the media circuit, other people began to come forward and share their own deep therapy remembrances of satanic rituals, satanic ritual abuse, I think is what is being termed now. Generally, these were young women. It tended not to be men. It tended to be women. And they would come out and they would show up on television and talk about very tearfully, very, very convincingly, you know, like in a way that you really believe they felt these things, their horrible memories, their traumas, you know, being forced to give birth to baby after baby so that those children could be eaten and sacrificed in rituals and their bones could be burned and so on and so forth. And this naturally caught the attention of law enforcement, and local law enforcement agencies and the FBI all took a real interest in this and said, we need to stop this from happening. And I don't know that they found any real evidence, but that did not keep people from going to jail anyway. And so there's a very famous or infamous case of a daycare where children came out after being sort of provoked into saying, like, have you experienced abuse? You know, show us on this doll. You know, that's kind of where the joke comes from. Show us on the doll where they hurt you. It's actually not funny because, like, kids, you know, were kind of coerced or just made to think, like, I should say things, bad things happen to me. That's what the adults want to hear. And that was the blame was pinned on teachers and people who ran this daycare center who did nothing. Like, there's no real evidence that they ever did anything wrong. But, you know, in court, I think juries are predisposed to believe children over adults. And the kids were saying, here's stuff that happened. And these people spent 5 years in jail for the crime, basically, of running a daycare center where their kids were convinced that they should say that they had been abused and indoctrinated into satanic cult actions with no real basis for that, because the kids were like 4 or 5. They didn't really know the difference between, you know, they're in the magical thinking era. So that's genuinely horrible.
Yeah, it's definitely, you've got kids going to their parents and they're like, Mrs. Teacher worships Satan, also she can fly. And there's a secret tunnel in the toilet under the thing. And they were like, oh, that sounds plausible. We better call the cops about that.
And that's not – Benito is not exaggerating. Those are like actual things that were reported in this trial, that they had talked about secret tunnels and that their teachers could fly.
I mean, and in 2025, we have skibbity toilets. So were the children wrong, I ask you?
I don't know what that is because I'm 42 years old.
it's a toilet with a head and he sings the Scatman song. It's, and like, he fights cameras.
Okay.
It's like Hinako. Is that the name of the Japanese ghost that lives in the toilet? But more annoying and grating? Anyway.
There's way more than one Japanese ghost that lives in the toilet.
That's true, but I'm thinking of the girl.
I feel like there's
more than one ghost girl that lives in the toilet.
It's an epidemic.
You mentioned, Jeremy, that like juries were predisposed to believe children. And I don't know if that's necessarily true. They believe children, but they don't believe that children can be coerced or that children can lie. Which is funny because, Benito, I know you're a horror movie guy, and like so many horror movies involving children are based on the fear of not being believed when you're a kid. Because of the assumption that kids say things that are not true all the time. Yeah. But if you know, juries are conditioned to believe that, like, if a cop shows up and uses their special investigation training techniques to get the truth out of a kid, then that we can believe, and that must mean that someone can fly. Whereas that's, I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. And everyone remembers being a kid and lying to the point of you now believe that lie. you now believe, like, oh yeah, no, I did not break that. That was not me. That did not happen. And it's this confluence of overcorrecting for not believing children, and also the child saying something that's either misinterpreted or misleading or is just flat out, you know, childhood nonsense, being given a stamp of approval by cops who also constantly lie and need to justify their continued existence.
I'm sorry, what are you saying about cops?
Cops lie all the time, and they're legally allowed to lie, and the Supreme Court has ruled that they are not legally allowed or legally required to help you.
Chris, I'm surprised. This is the first I'm hearing of your anti-police sentiment. It's a new one on me.
A dude who loves Commissioner Gordon more than most people love Batman.
That's
finally
true.
coming out hard.
But yeah, like these reports, I mean, Diamond already got the reference into the Ralph Wiggum thing, but it really does come down to, so many of these reports were just like, Principal Skinner and Mrs. Krabappel were sacrificing babies in the closet, and I saw one of the babies, and the baby looked at me. Like, that's legitimately like what it was. And they were like, the baby looked at you? You're going to jail.
Yeah, it's so wild, because, like, again, if you're predisposed to believe that the You're Wrong About podcast brings up a lot, Satan is alive and well on planet Earth, the kind of famous, like, evangelical I guess sermon is a way to put it, but, like, you know, the devil is out there. And if you believe that sincerely, then you are predisposed, like, you already believe that demons are out there, right? So having that confirmed can be compelling. But if you sit down and read any of these things, they are so demonstrably not true. Like, the Michelle Remembers is full of specific events that Michelle remembers, title of the book, that they're like, yeah, we looked, and there was no car accident where a lady died on that day, but that might just be because Satan worshippers use a different calendar. So it wasn't actually Christmas, it was Satan Christmas, which is in January.
Still in the Gregorian system?
Look, if Satan can plant dinosaur bones, he can alter calendars.
Yeah, there's literally a part of Michelle Remembers where something happens at New Year's, and in order to justify that it never actually happened on New Year's, they say that Satan New Year's happens on the 13th day of the 13th month, which is January. So Satan New Year's is January 13th.
That's Orthodox New Year, isn't it? What are they saying about the Orthodox Church?
Sounds like an unorthodox New Year to me.
That's the other thing that always gets me, is that, like, Michelle Remembers is a allegedly nonfiction work that stems so directly from The Exorcist and The Omen and Rosemary's Baby. But by the time you get to, like, the real, like, high-octane satanic panic stuff, it's into Jack Chick territory where Catholicism's not Christian enough. Like, Catholicism's actually secretly Satan worship.
It's actually worse. I don't know if you know. It's
actually worse, which is something that I have always thought was very funny about evangelical Christianity, is that, like, Catholicism isn't just bad. It's actually worse than worshiping the devil.
So, okay.
As someone of Irish descent, let me tell you.
This is mildly tangential, but this will not surprise you at all, but the bulk of my Facebook activity is spent in a group for people traveling to Europe for Christmas. And that won't surprise Chris. Other people might be like, why would you do that? But people have started in the last year or so posting pictures of themselves at various Krampus parades in Austria and Bavaria. And there has definitely been some boomer clapback at that. And I just remember someone, you know, people are like, oh, this has nothing to do with Christmas. This is satanic. And people are like, no, this is Christian, actually. And someone was just like, this has nothing to do with any mainstream Christianity that I know of. I had to stop myself from yelling at some grandma and being like, Catholicism is the most mainstream by numbers. There's more Catholics than anything else. And also, they're the first one. Yours is fake by comparison. So let them have the demon man at Christmas and shut up.
I will say that at the church that I went to as a kid, they never mentioned Christmas from the pulpit because that is a pagan celebration. It has nothing to do with actual Jesus, and it was totally verboten. We did have holiday parties, though.
That's absolutely a certain flavor of Protestantism. I mean, the Puritans, I mean,
it's the flavor that tastes like ambrosia salads at a potluck on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, like in New England, Christmas was literally against the law in the early New England colonies because, it was equal parts pagan and papish. Just as bad.
Wow.
I don't mean, don't want to turn this into me talking about Christmas all the time, but,
it's a little late for that. We're a couple of weeks past. So one thing I want to get to, going back to the satanic panic thing, is that all of this publicity and press and talk show circuit conversation resulted in a sort of feedback loop, an echo chamber. And I mentioned that police and law enforcement got really into this. And so they started to integrate like watching out for Satan kind of stuff into their training. And this was all pretty much based on things they found in or read in Michelle Remembers. So you started to get this kind of feedback loop where they were looking for things, but they were specifically looking for the things that were pulled from Michelle Remembers. So because they were specifically looking for those things and leading questions and questioning toward those sort of things, it led to more supposed incidents like that being brought to light and more people talking about things like this. So it just seemed like everywhere you went, there were impossible numbers of Satanism, satanic rituals happening behind the scenes. And, you know, in theory, everyone's lives should have been touched by this. And it just, I don't know, it just kind of kept getting worse and worse throughout the late 80s. It took a while before people would stop and say, wait a minute.
As soon as you get one headline that the police are investigating a satanic crime, that in turn will spark even more people to A, believe the original story, and B, come forward with their own tales. So it's like, it is a back and forth that just happens. And it's like a ping pong ball bouncing back and forth that, you know, it doesn't matter that they never find anything. It doesn't matter that you have people, you know, at the upper level saying, wait, there's no evidence of any of these situations, including Michelle Remembers. But as long as you have the headline that says police looking into this or police investigating this, because police, of course, love to tell you what they're investigating, because again, it makes it raises their profile, lets you know what they're doing all the time. It all just, it's circular, and it revs up, and it serves the entire 80s, I would say. And even in the early 90s, this just kept spinning and spinning and spinning. And it never really, it came to sort of a stop, at least as far as Michelle Remembers goes. But the fears that it drove up, I don't really think ever really went away.
No, they definitely didn't.
No, and if the X-Files had started 5 years earlier, Fox Mulder would definitely have been out there saying, well, you know, Scully, we need to look into this candle. Do you think this used to be a baby? He would have absolutely bought that shit.
I mentioned already my kind of mild obsession with police training videos that you could get on VHS, and that now you can find a lot of them on YouTube. And a lot of them are not fun or funny, but some of them are. The best, of course, is Surviving Edged Weapons. Which is a training video about knives that has an extremely good narrator describing knives like the Balisong or butterfly knife or the Mexican Sacatripe for gutting sheep and other warm-blooded mammals. But there is one that was from 1994.
Wow.
So the Satanic Panic goes up through, I would say, I mean, you said it never really went away. I would say it didn't stop until, like, stop being at its peak until maybe the early 2000s. Because the internet sparked a whole other wave of it. But the
law enforcement, and also 9/11 gives us a different group of people to otherize as well.
Yeah. But certainly, I mean, like, I was in high school when Columbine happened. And, you know, that was certainly blamed on the devil. Never on guns, which is weird. But definitely on the devil and the video game Doom. But the Law Enforcement Guide to Satanic Cults, I actually wrote an article for it for The Cracked Magazine back in 2015. And it's complete nonsense. Like, it talks about how cops everywhere need to be on the lookout for satanic initiation ceremonies in which someone promises to sacrifice children to the devil, and how Satanists believe that the head is the most important part of the body. You got to give them that one. I think we can all agree on that one. They often eat the brain to receive powers of the deceased person. The word often there is, does brain cannibalism really happen often enough that it warrants that? I'm not sure it does. But again, like, this is the same thing where, like, cops in the middle of nowhere get, like, tanks now, just in case terrorists decide to attack Roseville, Minnesota.
I will say this is kind of later in my notes, but, you know, the sort of lasting impact of the Satanic Panic and the imagery and fear that it instilled in people, like, that lasted well into the 21st century. Like, I had an aunt who refused to let her kids read or watch anything Harry Potter in, you know, into, like, the mid-2000s because it was Satan. There was witchcraft and wizards and stuff. And then she finally watched it and said, oh, this is kind of harmless. Now all those people are, like, totally on J.K. Rowling's side because she hates trans people as much as they do. But at the time, she was seen as, you know, evil. And, you know, there was a certain flavor of person who said these books are wrong and bad and promoting Satanism, and we should not accept this. So yeah, like, it seems weird to think of this moral panic lasting that long, but it absolutely did.
Yeah, I don't think it went away. It just changed, right? Like, you can see so much of so many of the same elements in QAnon conspiracy stuff. I mean, like, what's the difference between eating babies for power and then adrenochrome and whatever, all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, watching the documentary, Satan Wants You, like, maybe a third of the way through, I started thinking, like, wow, this is really reminding me of QAnon and Pizzagate and all that stupid shit.
For sure.
And at the end of the movie, they do tie it into that.
Yeah, so, I think you have to see it as part of the same impulse, right? Like, and yeah, of course, I mean, Harry Potter is a great example where it's like, and again, that's my mom being very concerned about witchcraft being real via fiction. I remember in the early 2000s, I was in college at this point, but I was home visiting for the holidays, and one of the Lord of the Rings movies was out, and so I was going to go see it in the theater. And I know my parents called me in to talk to me, and they were like, how do you see the Lord of the Rings movies as different from Harry Potter? And I just kind of stared at them, and they were like, oh, you don't really? And I was like, yeah, I don't, but not in the way that you see them as the same thing. Like, I think it's fine to do either one. I disagree now. Don't read Harry Potter, but you should read Lord of the Rings. But yeah,
one of them got a lot of cool swords.
It's true. And it's like, Mom, I don't have time to explain to you the theology of Jolkin, Rolkin, Rolkin, Tolkien. We don't have time for that. But it is different. And also, he is way smarter than
J.K. Rowling.
Jolin Coling Rowling. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I feel like there are points in the timeline where people's insanity changes to a different flavor. So you have the Satanic Panic for quite a while, and then 9/11 happens, And I was thinking earlier today about how, like, there's a certain kind of person that just lost their mind and became a different human altogether after 9/11. Like, you know, there was a website called Lilacs Institute back in the 90s, which was great. It was like this dude who was just like, hey, I found all these grotesque, you know, recipes in magazines from the 60s and 50s, and it's all this processed food and it's horrible. Let's make fun of it. But then 9/11 happened and all that went away, and he just became like this chest-thumping Islamophobe. Like, where did that come from? You were talking about Jell-O molds before, and now you're talking about how we should go blow up the Middle East? What's wrong with you?
I
feel COVID is another one of those.
I certainly hope that never happens to any creators whose work I enjoy.
Nope, no one in comics ever lost their entire damn mind as a result of 9/11.
Yes, thankfully,
just a shame
thankfully
that Frank
we all
Miller.
Only style follow. Thankfully, we only follow sane and stable people.
Yeah, Frank Miller unfortunately vanished in the Bermuda Triangle in 1993, and is we'll certainly not around.
He left behind some great works, though.
Yeah, and definitely didn't leave behind any extremely bad works that would have come out.
He died before that happened.
Yeah, fortunately for him. But you mentioned, you know, J.K. Rowling, and we've already mentioned like the Hays Code and the Comics Code and rock and roll and everything. More like it's the same moral panic. It never stops. It just takes different forms. And now it's the moral panic over trans people. And it's all like they're coming for your kids.
In my notes, this is called the post-war push-pull between conservatives and counterculture, a.k.a. olds versus kids. and it's a tale as old as time and a song as old as rhyme.
It really is.
Old people just hate kids. They just don't like them because I don't know why, actually.
And I mean, like, that's a thing that they bring up in the Michael Warnke episode of You're Wrong About is that a thing that I thought was very insightfully put, which is that the reason you see so much of this being set at, like, you know, Michael Warnke is like, oh yeah, I went to college in California and got real into drugs and Satan, and I did all the drugs at once because that's what Satan wanted. And the reason you see, like, the pushback against academia and against essentially kids going off to college is because that's where a lot of young people learn different things and learn to question, and it coincides with them becoming adults and pushing back against their parents' views, which happens in all forms, but generally due to youth and education is a more liberal pushback against conservatism.
Yeah, I think a really salient point from your notes, Jeremy, was talking about one, I think, an underappreciated element that leads to these kind of the fronting of these kind of moral panics is that kind of marriage of evangelicals and right-wing politics, which really kind of happened in the 70s as a result of the Southern Strategy.
Thanks, Nixon.
Really the shift, you know, because evangelicals were typically not as conservative as they have been since certainly the Reagan era. Like, my parents always, when I was growing up, they were always telling me, you don't always have to vote for the same person as us. We voted for Jimmy Carter. And I'm sure they have not voted for a Democrat since Jimmy Carter, but like, RIP Jimmy Carter. But, because then suddenly you're employing things that are at least superficially religious in order to consolidate political power. Things like, my kids will never read Harry Potter. I mean, on the surface, that seems like a virtue signaling, but it's costly signaling to show your devotion to a particular set of identity politics and those kind of values, right? You're showing you're part of an in-group. And so I think a lot of these same things, these moral panics seem there's so many elements to them, right? There's the sensationalism that's fueled by the need for 24-hour media. But then there's also, you know, there's the political element to it. And I lost my train of thought because my internet connection got unstable. But
yes,
I was gearing up for a doozy of a point. I feel very confident.
He was cooking.
I was.
I feel it in my heart. There. I got you. I got you.
You look like an angel. Walk like an angel. Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are. Devil in disguise.
Yeah, so I specifically feel like the satanic panic is kind of the result of a domino that started, you know, basically with World War II and the baby boom. And you had an entire generation that in America was born into unprecedented wealth, unprecedented technology, comfort. At the same time, there was the rise of media, the rise of advertising. It was just a generation of kids who grew up in a way that no one had ever grown up before. And I mean, even now we don't know how to deal with media. It's getting worse. But, you know, at the time, like, people just weren't media savvy enough to stop and say, hey, let's draw the line here. And media became more and more aggressive. Advertising became more and more aggressive. The boomers had their youth times of hedonism and hanging out in the mud at Woodstock and so forth, listening to rock and roll music and watching Elvis gyrate his hips and so forth. And then they started to age out. They got jobs. Usually it was often both parents getting jobs and they had kids. So, you know, their kids had to go home after school by themselves and were, you know, all alone for several hours until the parents got home, left with just the TV or their friends. So there were just a lot of factors here of a generation of basically carefree hedonists aging up and seeing their children start to come into their own, but kind of at a remove because, you know, suddenly both sides of the family, thanks to women's rights and progression, everyone was working. I don't know if I'm making a point here, actually. I just feel like basically there was an increased fear among boomers of what are our kids doing? Like, we know what we got up to when we were teens and tweens, and it wasn't anything good. And now we have our kids off by themselves, sitting at home or doing God knows what until we get back from work. So it could be that in this time, this gap between school and their parents coming home, that they're being indoctrinated by the devil. We don't actually know. So those were, I think, more factors that kind of fed into the satanic panic was just a change in society where kids were left on their own much more so than they had been in the past and left to their own devices. And parents weren't sure how to cope with that. Maybe there was some guilt there. I don't know. But certainly that's something that seems to be very localized to Generation X and maybe some of the early millennials, is that sort of latchkey kid phenomenon. Because now you don't have that. You have like parents hovering over their children at all times. School ends and immediately they're off to play sports or get lessons or whatever. And there's no, at least, you know, from what I've seen in our family, there's no sort of time for the kids to be kids and just have a few hours to hang out with their pals and play Dungeons and Dragons or whatever. Yeah. So.
And also, like, I know we're trying to have a fun time, haha, jokesy jokes discussion, but like, also the idea of child abuse is newer than you would think. Because honestly, the idea of children as we currently understand them is also newer than you think. The teenager is a 20th century invention, which isn't to say that people were 12 years old and then became adults. But, well, I mean, some of them.
Kind of. I mean, that's kind of what some lawmakers are trying to roll it back to, making child marriage legal again.
But yeah, like that, the sort of era of your life where you are a teenager or a young adult is very much kind of a like a post-World War II invention in a lot of ways. It changes culture. It's why culture changes so rapidly in the mid-20th century, and why you have an entirely new and different media landscape of stuff that does include stuff like video games to kind of try and wrestle this discussion back to its nominal purpose. Like, the rise of the teenager as an economic and cultural force is one of the most important things that has happened in the history of the last 100 years, easily, because that's where we get Elvis, that's where we get the Beatles, that's where we get Marvel Comics, that's where we get Dungeons and Dragons. And the idea of not hitting your kids is kind of new in a way that's, like, really, from a very modern perspective, shocking to think about, that it's not that long ago that violence against children was, like, just what you did in order to teach them lessons. So the changing social landscape of realizing that, like, oh, there's this thing that we do that's bad, but we can't be bad, even if we did it. So any abuse of children had to be at the hands of Satan or Democrats or pizza parlors or Joseph Robinette Biden or whatever. Like, you know, it's all the same moral panic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
sorry, that's a bummer.
I'm old enough to have gone to school when corporal punishment was a thing, and you misbehaved and you got sent to the office so the principal could take a paddle to your ass.
Yeah.
That was just a thing that happened.
My mom was a teacher, and that was, like, phased out while, like, over the course of her career.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is wild.
So bring the kids along. It's good, clean family fun. What have you got to lose? If you like the 6 o'clock news, then you'll love Nature Trail to Hell. Nature Trail to Hell. Nature Trail to Hell in 3D. Nature Trail to Hell in 3D. Nature Trail to Hell in 3D. Nature Trail to Hell in 3D.
But I'm glad you mentioned video games, because my next intent was to bring this back around to talk about how Satanic Panic affected video games so that we can kind of bring this home and wrap it up. But there was a definite knock-on effect, not just in video games, but also in video game adjacent media, such as movies and film and, dare I say, tabletop games. but video games, even though I can't really think of instances of video games being held up as demonic and horrible and, oh my God, Satan is here, aside from the whole Congress thing. Thank you, Joe Lieberman. There was still, I think, a lot of preemptive attempts to avoid that sort of thing on the behalf of publishers. Nintendo of America, certainly had a different approach to content in America than it did in Japan and Europe, which you saw pretty much at the beginning of the NES era, when they didn't localize the game Devil World, which until 2023, when it came to Nintendo Switch Online, was, I believe, the only game designed by Shigeru Miyamoto not to reach the US, because it was about the devil. And it has almost nothing whatsoever to do with anything in the Bible. I mean, you, like, collect crosses and you can pick up a Bible book and the devil is, like, dancing around at the top of the screen, but he looks just like Ganon. He's blue and he's got red boiler shorts on. Like, he's
we all know what the devil really... looks like, Jeremy. You didn't have to explain that to us. He's blue and he wears little shorts.
It's a very different view of the devil than you see in most pop culture. But they just didn't localize that. And they took a stand against really sort of any religious content in their NES games, Super NES games. There was a great article that Drew Mackey just published on how the hell did, you know, they localize Ghosts and Goblins for Nintendo systems when Nintendo was opposed to anything to do with religion, just out of caution and fear. And these entire games are about running into hell, killing Satan with crosses so you can save a princess. That's tricky. So there were a lot of weird localization choices, a lot of bowdlerization. Sometimes things made it through, especially in the early days of the NES. You do see crucifixes, crosses, you know, just things that kind of slip past the censors. I mean, oh my God, the title screen for Scoon by IREM, the NES submarine shooter, it has a topless mermaid with two tiny pink pixel nipples holding a crucifix on the title screen right there. That wow. is like the nadir of the Nintendo era. Just such filth leading our children into damnation.
Is that pre or post Mortal Kombat?
Oh, this was 1987. It was way Ooh. Before Mortal Kombat.
Oh my God.
This was an NES game. This was early on, but it was an early on game. So they hadn't gotten quite as stringent about their localization policies. And, you know, I think they just kind of gradually tightened those up as things kind of slipped through, like, oh, Golgo 13 just had sex in a hotel and smoked a cigarette. Well, maybe we should be more careful about sex in video games from now on. Oops, there was a naked harpy boob in the Kid Icarus manual. Let's be cautious with that. And, you know, it was kind of the same thing with crosses, crucifixes, other religious imagery. Like, they got some of it, you know. In The Legend of Zelda, the Book of Magic was called the Bible in the Japanese version, but it's Book of Magic in the US version. But still, you know, Link's shield
Link still
has a
cross on his shield, which yeah. does imply the existence of Hylian Jesus.
In Zelda 2, one of the items you pick up is a crucifix that you use in order to protect you against ghosts in the graveyard. Once you have the crucifix, you can see ghosts in the graveyard area, which are otherwise invisible. So, yes, in Hyrule, Jesus died for someone's sins. I don't know. And then he ascended to the golden
Jesus
land.
Jesus was, of course, the first male born to the Gerudo in 100 years. Couldn't make it through it. I apologize.
You might be thinking of Paul Atreides.
Mm. The one that always gets me is Castlevania, because I remember as a kid, like, reading that manual. And Jeremy, do you know anything? Have you heard of Castlevania? Have you ever done anything about?
Like, I've tried. I've tried,
like,
to teach.
That's like Metroid, right? That's like Metroid.
Not the first one, but the boomerang was referred to as a boomerang, and I'm like. I know what a boomerang looks like because I watch a lot of cartoons, and they don't look like T's. They don't look
It's an X that's kind it's of an X. Tilted 45 degrees.
It's an X for no Draculas.
But I will say Symphony of the Night actually does have a boomerang and a crucifix item separately. Does. Yeah.
But I always thought that was funny because, like, playing that game and, like, reading that manual, I'm like, I know who Dracula is. And I know that, like, one of the things you do against Dracula is you have a cross. Like, I've got the orange and black book from my school library that we all remember. Like, I know what you do with vampires. You didn't have to hide that one, Nintendo of America. Somebody get Redmond on the phone.
But they did. I mean, you know, there were still elements that made it into Castlevania games for a while. And then I think the big notable change with Castlevania was Super Castlevania 4. The opening screen is a tombstone being struck by lightning, and then Dracula's spirit flies out. In the Japanese version, there is a cross on top of the tombstone. In the American version, no cross.
A thing that always made this make no sense to me was when I would see people get, you know, get really satanic panicky about stuff like, Castlevania or whatever, or D&D, obviously being a big one, because it has like demons in it and like monsters, and being like, yeah, but they're the bad guys. Like, you should be all in on this. Mm-hmm. You should be hell yes, let's go beat the devil to death with a whip, or let's go overthrow Asmodeus from the throne of hell. Like, because they're the bad guys. It's like being mad at Raiders of the Lost Ark for having Nazis in it. It's like, yeah, but the good guy's there to shoot them all. And then it becomes this weird thing of like, even the acknowledgement of demons in anything that is secular is secretly, like, you might think they're the bad guys, but then why do they have such good stats? And it's to show you their secret power.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely hit Final Fantasy games. The most powerful white magic spell traditionally in Final Fantasy has been called Holy. And in Final Fantasy 1 on NES, that was localized as Fade, so you can make the zombies fade away. In Final Fantasy 4, Final Fantasy 2 on Super NES, that was localized as White. You use white power to take out evil enemies. I don't know that that's actually an improvement. I think Holy is better, but they were just super cautious about that.
Was Holy the third version in Final Fantasy of Hole and Hola?
Mm-hmm. Holaga.
Holaga, yeah.
You know, I know it's not a video game per se, but we should probably, certainly of the era of its time, we should probably talk about Magic cards, because
yeah,
I got into Magic pretty early, but not early enough, because a friend of mine had to show me cards. Like, oh yeah, I got these cards last year, but they're changed now. You can't get them anymore because people were upset that you summon demons, or, you know, cards that in the Black Magic, which of course it's Black Magic, would have like pentagrams and things in them that were, you know, scary. And those cards just went, they either would be edited to remove, you know, anything, like any particular imagery, or they would just be completely wiped out. Like, you can't, no, you cannot summon Lord of the Pit. We're going to come up with a new card that punishes you to summon it. But it's like, that was definitely scary. That was scary to a lot of people right away. And, you know, again, I'm in New York. I'm like, wait, why are people scared of a piece of paper with a pentagram on it?
I mean,
paper can be the scariest thing of all.
I definitely heard a lot of panic about Magic the Gathering and how you could, like, per the text on the cards, you could sacrifice a creature to gain more power. And it's like, okay, calm down. But, like, there's a level where all of this makes sense, right? There's a level where like, you know, yeah, okay, this has demons in it. This has Draculas and spirits, and you're summoning monsters and whatever. Okay, cool. And then you get to the famous backlash against Pokemon, which, look, I love Pokemon. I have three Bulbasaurs in easy reach right now. I can grab one right here. That's my boy, number one. Number one in the decks, number one in my hearts. Pokemon has narrative problems. It is about befriending and loving adorable creatures that then, like, headbutt each other into unconsciousness. Like, but that's never the problem. It's Benito, you might know the name of the one pastor who was a frequent fixture on Everything is Terrible back when that was a going internet concern. And his whole problem would be that, like, Pokemon is about mastering and controlling demons and sending them to do your will. And it's like, well, they're not really demons. I mean, some of them are ghosts.
They're just cute little guys.
Sometimes they're a sword or three moles.
I got a tattoo with a sword.
I think I've talked about this on Apocrypals, so Chris might know, but I absolutely do have a cousin that organized a neighborhood Pokemon burning, and that did happen.
Always on the right side of history when you're gathering together to burn things publicly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So it's worth noting that Michelle Remembers came out in 1980, which I would argue was the year that home video games in America really became a thing. That was the year that Space Invaders came out for Atari 2600, and everyone said, I gotta own an Atari. And from that point on, aside from that little blip, 1983, 84, who knows what happened there, home video games were a big thing. And arcade games, also very popular. And in the early days of arcade games, sometimes people would get upset, like parent groups or whatever, would get upset about contents of games, such as Death Race, where you run over stickmen as you drive across the country. Okay, sure. I mean, it's stickmen, but sure, the idea is that you're running over people. They're zombies. But yes, they once were people. They just like to eat brains now. They were upset about the game Phoenix, a space shooter in the Space Invaders vein, where the Space Invaders are birds. There were, you know, people who said, this is teaching children to kill animals, which is ridiculous. But anyway, in 1982, Midway created a shooter called Satan's Hollow. And I don't remember seeing anyone squawk about that. I don't remember seeing complaints. I don't think it was that popular. No one probably noticed. But between 1982 and I want to say like 1992, I can't find any game releases for American home systems that have the word devil or demon or Satan in the title. It's in 1992 that you get Devil's Crush for Sega Genesis, a game about basically playing pinball on Satan's face, which, you know, again, he's there, he's in the background, he's not your friend, he's actually antagonizing you by sending out little pop-ups and traps for your ball to fall into. So really, it's not teaching you to be on Satan's side, it's teaching you that Satan wants you to lose your pinball token. But there is a decade in there where you just did not have that naming convention, that terminology in the title of video games. And I think it was just publishers being extraordinarily cautious. And you did sometimes have imagery leak into like NES games, but a lot of times it was through licenses. So like, you know, you had Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street turned into video games. And those are pretty antiseptic, but still it kind of gets you like, They're sort of gateways into the movies. The kids play the video game and are like, I wonder what the movie is like. And then they get an eyeful. You know, you had stuff like in Ninja Gaiden, you're fighting a demon. You gotta get the demon statues so that you can kill Jackie O, which means Demon King in Japanese. And when you go to his temple where Bloody Mars throws fireballs at you before you fight a bunch of ninjas and eagles and then take on Jackie O, it's like just plastered with pagan symbols, but these are all like Stars of David turned into pentacles or hecticles or whatever they're called. They're just inscribed in a circle. But the thing is, you have to make it, you have to be like Fred Savage's little brother in The Wizard to be able to get to the final stage of Ninja Gaiden. So I don't think most people saw that and said, wait a minute, this looks demonic. Like that's a big ask. But that was out there. And, you know, like I said earlier, Nintendo got better about finding that stuff and ironing it out and preventing it from showing up in the US versions. So you had something like Monster Party, that really weird, trippy Bandai game. And it's got sort of like hellish imagery in it, but it's kind of cartoonish too. So maybe people didn't take it seriously. It just becomes less and less common as time goes by. And you see fewer and fewer crosses and game series that had some imagery, some, you know, like naked statues or crucifixes or whatever, like their sequels, you see less and less of that over time. And it wasn't until, what, really, like the Wii era and DS that Nintendo finally kind of pulled back and said, okay, we're not going to be helicopter parents anymore. You can have whatever you want. And I feel like, you know, Nintendo's big push to iron that stuff out of their games also kind of opened up an opportunity for their competitors, Sega, NEC, etc., to sort of differentiate themselves from Nintendo by releasing games like Splatterhouse and Devil's Crush and saying like, hey, we're not like Nintendo. We're not, you know, we're not your mom. We want you to have fun and do cool stuff that's bad and a little evil. So come play Sega Genesis and you can be Jason beating up demons with a 2x4. That's way cooler than being Mario eating a mushroom on the back of a dinosaur. Actually, that's kind of cool too. Anyway, the point is, the caution and the general sort of atmosphere in the U.S. where matters of Satan were concerned really did have this sort of subtle effect on the content that we saw in video games. And if you look at, you know, the Famicom library in Japan versus the NES library in America, there's so much more demonic, dark, evil Satan imagery. But over in Japan, they didn't have the satanic panic. And also, Western religions are just like a thing that they sort of co-opt and they're fun. It's like a goofy, silly, foreign thing, kind of like ninjas for us. It's kind of the same essential thing. Or maybe Diamond can speak more to that.
It's funny how often I can walk around in modern Japan and just see a, you know, what I view as a Star of David, but of course it's just, you know, it's just two triangles. Or, you know, the... not swastika, but the manji, which goes the other way. That's an extremely common symbol in Japan. And you just see it. I mean, I used to work in an elementary school and there was a big hill outside the elementary school. And someone probably decades ago had sort of cultivated like these bushes in the shape of a manji. And if I was a, you know, more reactionary, less chill person, when I first got to that school, I might have like had a heart attack, but I'm just like, okay, I know what that is. That's got nothing to do with Nazis. Those are just some bushes in a hill. But it still made me giggle. I'm a human being, goddammit. You know, I worked there for like 9 years. I still like, oh, I can see the manji today. Oh, it's too foggy. I can't see it. I wonder what could be on that hill. Probably anything. And then it's just funny to me that somehow in this response to, you know, we need to avoid Satan, it became this, okay, we need to avoid everything that could possibly be religious. Just don't get any of them riled up. When it's like, oh, you think having the cross in the game as a symbol of power would be endorsed by the church. But no, it's better just to not have it at all, which you then have years later where someone says, I don't know what's going on in France these days, but didn't France try to ban all religious symbols because they wanted people to stop wearing, like, you know, head coverings? It's like, okay, well, we'll just ban all religious coverings. That's okay, right? So no more crosses or these robes that you prefer to wear outside. And everyone's like, well, that seems like an overcorrection, but all right.
No other problems in France. Nothing else to worry about. I do wonder, though, if, like, given how even in the absence of things to see the devil in, that you start getting into the pattern recognition apophenia of like everything's actually a secret symbol. I do wonder if Nintendo was right or wrong. Like, because I'm honestly not sure. I would have preferred it, like, on a personal level, if, you know, they were just like, yeah, Simon Belmont's got a cross and a Bible because he's gonna go fight Dracula, and you know about Dracula, that's what he does. But I understand why they would just be like, no, no, that's an X and a book. That's fine. We don't want to deal with it at all. I do wonder if at the time that was the safer choice and that was the more business-minded choice.
There were other factors involved there, such as a general distrust in America in the late 1980s for Japanese businesses having outsized power and influence in the U.S. And I think Nintendo was very sensitive to that and did not want to spark anger and cause problems. They did anyway. People definitely noticed. Atari fans were like, how dare you? But I think a lot of that influenced their overly cautious approach to religious symbolism. But, you know, it's a combination of just the extreme sensitivities around satanic imagery in the 1980s and also the extreme sensitivities around Japanese businesses making money and influencing children in America. It all kind of comes back to the children, which is funny because, you know, after all of this complaining and panic and so forth, the satanic panic, Pizzagate, QAnon, all of those purport to be about protecting kids. And yet I don't feel like American kids are actually safer than they were in the 1980s. I mean, there aren't as many abductions now, but there's a lot more school shootings and horrible things like that happening. So what was it all for in the end? I guess just media sensationalism, a few people making some money off of stuff, the Catholic Church fomenting fear so people would go to church and be safe from satanic cults. But I don't know. In the end, it just seems like a really unsavory chapter of American history that did have a knock-on effect with things that we enjoyed and people who listen to this podcast would have enjoyed. But it didn't do anything good. It didn't accomplish anything. It just made some people's lives miserable. And I don't feel like Michelle Smith and Larry Pazder were I don't feel like they came out of things better for it, too. I mean, they got married, but it tore their families that existed already apart. And I don't know, based on what people were saying in the documentary, which admittedly are subjective, it doesn't sound like they really had a happily ever after together. So I don't think that anyone came out ahead after the Satanic Panic. I feel like it just made things worse for everyone all around, kind of universally. And that's a shame.
Yeah, I said earlier that, like, I don't think they were charlatans, you know? I don't want to give them any kind of a pass on, like, the harm that, like, Michelle remembers specifically really kicked off and did, like ruined people's lives, for sure. But I don't think they were in it for the money. I think there's a sincerity into what they thought they were doing. Virtually everyone that comes after is a charlatan and a huckster and is trying to scam you.
You don't think Geraldo Rivera's 3-hour expose on the Satanic Panic in 1987 was done out of the goodness of his heart?
Hard to say. Hard to say.
It's kind of unfortunate that given the evils of capitalism, what happens more often than not is that whenever anything becomes popular, there is a rush to make more of that thing, you know? And whether that thing is, you know, when you look at your iPhone or Android device, every single app now has to have their own little version of Stories or whatever they call it, like some kind of disposable video feature, because that's what everyone needs. Everyone needs to have scrolling, you know, I guess, or some kind of TikTok scrolling video horizontally where you can keep scrolling forever. Like, everyone needs that on every feature. Even Twitter, before everyone left Twitter, decided that, oh, if you watch a video on Twitter, what you want to do is you want us to show you a random video from someone else right afterwards, right? And it's like, no one wants that. No one asked for that, but that's what you get. So in this case, you have a book that made a lot of money. You had people who went on TV and got a lot of attention. So all of a sudden, hey, we got this person. Hey, we got this person. We all have our own story. Let's be on TV together. And it just, it makes money. It made money for people. And that's reason enough, unfortunately. And, you know, whatever, even the Michelle Rimmers obviously was not made, you know, it was not a charity. They sold the book to make money. At no point, even today, Michelle, as far as I know, has never recanted or even just said, hey, you know what? That was exaggerated. Or even if she tried to, you know, she could, at this point, she could even try to blame Larry, who's been dead for 20 years. She could say, oh, Larry convinced me to do that. It was all Larry's fault. As far as I know, she has just let it go. Like, oh, I'm just going to remove myself from this conversation. But, you know, whatever her intent, that's what happened. And she made her money and she got to keep her money.
Yeah. And in this case, it's a factor of, like, not only is there a rush to capitalize on something's sensationalism, but in this case, the more there is, the more it confirms, they confirm each other. Because you might be able to read Michelle Remembers and be like, well, obviously this is nonsense. But if you read Michelle Remembers and The Satan Seller and Go Ask Alice, and they're all kind of hitting on the same, like, secret John Wick underworld of Satan assassins everywhere, then you're like, well, are all these people just making it up? And the answer is yes. But it becomes, you actually have to ask the question before you answer it.
I love that moment in the movie where Pazder and Michelle Smith go to the FBI. They actually address the FBI and passes up there. It's like, you know what? Most of these stories about satanic ritual abuse are phonies. I'm here today, you know, receiving my speaker's fee to tell you how you can discern between the fake stories and the real stories. And the FBI agent who's been behind this whole thing is kind of like, yeah, I kind of stopped taking notes during his presentation.
Yeah, look, we all know that some of this stuff doesn't make any sense and isn't real, but mine, though.
Yeah.
That
was basically,
that
yeah, boiled down to, like, if I said it, if it corroborates with Michelle remembers, then it's good. Any final thoughts on the Satanic Panic here on episode 666 of Retronauts?
I think it was a bad idea and we shouldn't have done it.
I'm going to pass that along to them. Let them know.
I wish
your thumbs down.
I wish look at the Satanic Panic and the many decades we've had of the aftermath. I wish it was more unique. But the more, you know, it's one of these things where it's like over the last few years, you know, a lot of things have gotten bad in America. But if you want to call a silver lining, it's hard to say, a slight gray lining, not quite as black as the rest of the cloud. If there's any bright spot, it's that people who look at the bad things that have happened, it's forced them to look back and realize how much of this stuff is not new, you know. A lot of the stuff that went wrong that, you know, let Satanic Panic explode and cause people to turn on each other, a lot of that malice and, you know, quick to judgment, a lot of that stuff has been laid in our country for centuries, you know. As a young kid, I went to the Salem Witch Museum, you know, in Massachusetts. And that is very much, hey, I saw, you know, Goody Patterly or whatever. She was out by the church and she talked to an animal, and that means she's a witch. And, well, if we put these heavy stones in her and she dies, that means she was innocent. Shit. I can't argue with that.
I've said it 5 or 6 times now, but every moral panic is the same moral panic. And they're all bullshit. And it's especially useful to remember that now when we are in the midst of an ongoing, like, spike in the current moral panic. And of course, the tricky thing is trying to distinguish the excesses of a moral panic of, like, you know, Satan is coming for your children versus people saying things like, hey, maybe don't make racisms in your video games. And each side of that debate thinks the other is a moral panic. One of them's wrong and one of them is right. And if you want to determine who, just look at who is being victimized and what they are trying to take away. And in the case of the Satanic Panic, you can also just read the things they say and go, well, hang on, that doesn't make any sense if I say this out loud to another human being.
I agree. Well, okay. So anyway, Satanic Panic. Not a great idea. Folks, don't do it again. Make sure you avoid it in the future. That's my recommendation, and that's what I'm going to go with. Anyway, thank you, all three of you, for joining me for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this first furtive attempt at trends and influences, talking about the bigger social events that helped shape video games. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you didn't, well, next time we'll do better. So as you may know, Retronauts is a podcast that you can find on the internet, and you can listen to it by downloading it from many, many free platforms. But also, if you'd like to get it a week early at a higher bitrate quality with better audio and no advertisements, you can go to patreon.com/retronauts and subscribe to Retronauts, and you will get all of those things. And if you subscribe for a little more, $5 a month instead of three, which is the cost of like one 6-piece chicken McNuggets now, I think. You can get even more extra stuff, including weekly columns by Diamond here and cool bonus episodes and so on and so forth. So that's patreon.com/retronauts. The vast majority of our ability to create this podcast comes from your subscriptions and enthusiasm for the show. So we highly recommend checking us out on Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. Okay, that's the pitch. I'm done. Let's see. Benito, I don't think you've been on Retronauts before, so please tell us where we can find you on the internet.
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned at the top of the show, me and Chris do a show called Apocrypals. It is a comedy show about biblical literature that also tries to take the material seriously while being fun. But I also do a podcast called Friends Till the End, with my friends Matt and Erica. It is becoming a generalized horror movie podcast, but it is nominally about the Child's Play franchise. So you can check that one out. We review all sorts of different movies. But you can also find me on Blue Sky, BenitoSereno.bSky.social, where I talk about all sorts of stuff. And you can find my link in my bio there to my different social media presences. But the most important one is Patreon, patreon.com/BenitoSereno, all one word, where you can, check out all the different work I've been doing. I do medieval and early modern Latin translations. I'm writing a long, comprehensive book on Christmas folklore. I post horror movie reviews, all sorts of different stuff, all on my Patreon. And you can even subscribe for free. There's a free tier. Anything you can do there to support my work is great. Thanks.
Cool. Chris Sims.
In addition to Apocrypals, I am also on some other podcasts, including War Rocket Ajax, a weekly comic book and pop culture podcast that is in its 15th year,
wow.
I think. 16th, maybe, once we get to, I think it's August is the anniversary. We hit 666 episodes a while back. I do not remember what we did. But you can listen to that every Monday. It is a good time. I host that with Matt Wilson, who is also one of the hosts of Friends to the End. And I do some other stuff that will be coming back in 2025. And I also currently don't have another job. So if you would like to pay me to write things for you or to just come on and talk about things with the to tell you why cops are bad, because that's generally what it's going to be, then by all means, check out my website at the-isb.com. Where you can read some of the things that I've written, including a very fun new piece that I'm working on right now that is secretly about Star Trek.
Oh, why keep it secret?
Because I think it's fun to start writing something without people knowing what it is until I have tricked them into reading about how Persona 5 is my favorite video game.
Fair enough.
In this case, it will be about Star Trek.
Diamond Fight.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for the intro earlier with the Patreon, although I don't know how I feel about comparing my work to the value prospects of Chicken McNuggets. I don't know if I can compare, you know?
Chicken McNuggets are not a good deal these days. But Diamond Fight's though. Columns are a phenomenal deal.
Thank
Highly
you.
Highly recommended.
I'm a big fan of that. Yeah, we've been doing this, you know, I'm writing this weekly columns now since 2020, so we're well past 5 years, so there's a lot of columns there if you want to read them. But yes, besides Retronauts, if you want to find me on the internet, the keyword there is Fight Club. F-E-I-T is my last name. C-L-U-B is another word for a small circle of people who might be killing babies, but we don't know that. Fight Club has a website, fightclub.me, which contains zero satanic content, guaranteed. There's just no Satan on fightclub.com. You can't. There's no S. You can't have a Satan in fightclub.com with no S. It's math.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm not into numerology, but I will say that you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Blue Sky, which has no numbers whatsoever. jparrish.bluesky.social. You can find me at limitedrungames.com, sometimes creating cool stuff that goes in the video games you purchase from that very website, such as hand-drawn maps of Castlevania games. I do know what they are, Chris. That's so great. Oh, I forgot. I've been doing that for months. How could I forget that? Months of my life. And also
only
you can
months,
find me on,
though.
Only months. You can also, I mean, that's what I've been doing like day in, day out for months. Also on YouTube, where you can find me under the name Jeremy Parrish. And I guess that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts. Retronauts you can find on social media as well, doing its little Retronauts thing, having little parasocial relationships with other podcasts. It's really cute. Highly recommend checking us out, listening to us, and doing other assorted things. But for now, we are going to sign off and say, get thee behind me, Satan.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.